You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Carnegie Europe on a Friday morning before a long weekend. You're all heroes for me that you're here. And you'll even be more heroic that most of you will probably go back to the office after this. So thanks for being here this morning. Thanks for joining us for a little preview on the Turkish elections, which will be held on Sunday, of course. And since Carnegie Europe is in a very comfortable position to have Sinan Ilgin as our visiting scholar here, what smarter idea, what better idea is there than to actually invite him to give us a glimpse into what's ahead of us? We are joined by Kadri Gürsel, who is a Turkish columnist for Milliyet newspaper, has been doing this for the last 4 years, and is one of the most pronounced Turkish public voices, a public intellectual, we would probably say here, a critical voice vis-a-vis the government and the AKP party, but a very intelligently critical voice, which probably makes him even more dangerous. And it's great that we have dangerous people here at Carnegie Europe this morning. Turkey, of course, is the big, big elephant in the room in Turkey, in Europe. The Europeans, I think, have not entirely grasped what's out there for them just around the corner. A major political player, a big force in Europe, and very likely to become an even bigger force. And I think most of Europe is in neglect or prefers not to see it this way, which is, of course, a grave mistake, a grave intellectual mistake, a grave geopolitical mistake. So Turkey will be on our agenda, very high on our agenda, for quite some time to come. The elections that will be held, and we'll hear all about it this morning, hopefully, are portrayed sometimes as, watershed elections. Some say not much of a surprise to be expected from it. But probably what's going to be very interesting is what comes after the elections, because the elections themselves don't seem to be all that unpredictable in a way. And we have two experts here this morning who will talk about both the domestic side, what's in it for Turkey, and also the foreign policy side. How will Turkey translate the election results into its foreign policy activism? Just a couple of snapshots ahead of the elections. This is the first parliamentary election in Turkey for which people younger than 30 are eligible for parliament. And this is the first election in which it is not a crime to campaign in another language than Turkish. So we have a couple of small changes. These are maybe just little things, but they tell you that Turkey is in motion, changes rapidly, and that we're all witness of a great power in the making, I believe. I don't want to lose much more time. We'll start with Sinan, who will fill us in on the current domestic situation. And then we switch over and talk about also the foreign policy side, but I understand that because our guest is fresh in from Turkey yesterday, he will, of course, also give us a bit of an atmospheric wrap-up. What's the mood, what's the atmosphere in Turkey before these elections? Thank you very much to both of you. Sinan, it's yours.
Thanks a lot, Jan, and really nice to be here with many friends around the table. Now, I'm an analyst. And the work that I do is much facilitated when there's tension in the air. Namely, when I write about things whose outcome is uncertain, it's much better for me because I get a much wider readership, people are interested and in trying to evaluate what the outcome is going to be. Now, in this particular case, I have a particular challenge because, as you have heard from Jan and, of course, from the commentariat on the Turkish elections, the first outcome of the elections, namely who is going to win, is by and large not an uncertainty unless, there's a very extraordinary event in the 24 or 48 hours ahead of us. It is pretty certain, pretty sure, that the ruling party will get a majority on Sunday. Now, this was the easy part. The difficult part is to assess what sort of majority. Because depending on the answer to that question, the whole environment of Turkish politics is going to change. And that is essentially what is going to determine both the domestic political environment, but also Turkey's foreign relations, and in particular its relationship with the EU. And now let me just say a few words on this one. It is what's at stake at the elections is really the margin of victory. And here it's because the ruling party, and in particular the Prime Minister Erdogan, made clear that they want a constitutional majority, which is two-thirds of the number of seats in parliament, and it translates into 367 seats in a parliament of 550. Now, that is the objective of the ruling party. Are they going to achieve it? Very unlikely. Very unlikely because even though today the polls put the ruling AKP in the margin of 45 to 50%, which by itself is an extremely credible and extremely strong degree of support, because Turkey is a heterogeneous society. There are about 24 parties participating in the elections. So really, a single party getting almost half of the popular vote is certainly an accomplishment. But even with that vote, the ruling party is very unlikely to get the majority, the constitutional majority that it seeks. Now, they seek this constitutional majority essentially because the PM has this idea that Turkey should switch to a presidential system. US style or French style, we don't know it yet, but he stated his objectives very clearly. Of course, there is also a personal dimension to this, and he has made no secret about it, of harboring goals of becoming Turkey's next popularly elected president so that he can stay in power for another 5 plus 5, 10 years. And incidentally, you know, at least for a European observer who's come to Turkey and watched the Turkish elections, there is something very interesting about it, which in any normal society you wouldn't expect. And that is AKP is campaigning with the slogan of 2023. Now, 2023 is the centennial of the Turkish Republic, and they have been stating all their goals related to 2023, big infrastructure projects, big public works, and so on and so forth. But then, when you stand for a second and think, there are still two more elections till 2023. So, you know, intellectually, it's a bit absurd to promise what you are going to do in 2023 in 2011 and basically structure your whole electoral campaign on the basis of that. But the subliminal message is that the ruling party, and in particular the PM, wants to get a mandate strong enough already today or in 2 days' time to be able to continue the work until 2023. And that's essentially the presidential system, or switch to a presidential system. Now, again, that's very unlikely to happen because of the distribution of votes, because in addition to AKP, there's going to be the main opposition party, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but also other parties that will also be represented in parliament. So the realistic objective for the ruling party is to get 330 seats in parliament, which will enable them to actually force a referendum on this issue of constitutional amendments and the switch to a presidential system. So even though we hear the PM saying that he really wants the constitutional majority, the more realistic assessment and the more realistic objective that the ruling party has set for itself is this threshold of 330 seats. And that is essentially what is at stake. That is what everybody in Turkey is focused on, and that is how the results, the outcome of the elections will be assessed. Now, will they get 330? 50-50. We don't know. They might come close. They might get it, they might not, but that is essentially where the battle is. If they get less than 330, that will mean that they will not have the ability, neither by themselves, nor by way of a referendum, to change the constitution. And here, on a more personal note, I think, and I agree here with the economist that Jan is holding in his hand, that this is going to be a good thing for Turkish democracy. For the ruling party to get less than 330, more than the simple majority that will enable them to form a government, but less than the type of threshold for the referendum. Because then it will oblige them to really enter into substantive negotiations with the rest of the Turkish body politic on constitutional amendments. And there is going to be a constitutional amendment, because Turkey has some outstanding problems, and Kadri will talk about these in a little while, in particular the Kurdish question, and this needs to be addressed through a set of constitutional amendments. And there's every reason to believe that this is going to be on Turkey's agenda, in particular because this is not only a promise of the ruling party, but it's also an objective that has now been strongly espoused by Turkey's main opposition party, the CHP. And here I just want to say a few words about the CHP, because I also think that it is going to be very important to watch, and it's going really to determine the atmospherics of the Turkish domestic system. Now, CHP is a party that traditionally, although it claims that it is from the center-left, that its instincts were not very liberal in the political sense. They were, for the past decades, really much more conservative in terms of their political agenda, much more wedded to the idea of the sanctity of the state, and much less progressive than the social democratic parties that we see in the rest of the continent. Now that is changing. That is changing at a very rapid scale, because CHP has a new leader at its helm, and he has really adopted a very different rhetoric. The rhetoric today of this main opposition party is much less nationalistic. It's much more liberal. It's much more ambitious in terms of the democratic agenda that it sets for itself and for the country. And that seems to be paying off. So we will see, and for me that is really the second most important element of the outcome on Sunday, whether the Turkish people will actually give their support to this transformation that the main opposition party has started. Because if they do, this is going to consolidate this direction that the new party leader for CHP wants to adopt. And it will also be a good thing for Turkish politics domestically, because for the first time in recent memory, we will have two parties in government that can actually establish a coalition on an ambitious reform agenda. Before, that was not possible. At some point, AKP took the leadership, but they did it, especially after 2004, with their own volition, without so much the participation of the political opposition. So I think now the country has a chance to establish this sort of political alliance on issues like a democratic reform agenda, but also on issues like relationship with Europe. Because here as well, the former CHP played a more destructive role by being absurdly anti-European, Eurosceptic. And here we have now the opportunity for a fundamental change in this type of behavior. So I think I would like to end here to also leave room for Q&A and listen to what Kadri has to say.
Sinan, thank you very much. I just have a very quick follow-up. Should the AKP, just speculatively now, get the 330 votes that you were talking about, and they can force the referendum, will they get the majority for a constitutional change the way they envision this new constitution to be? Is it fairly safe to say that if they can push the referendum, they'll get their way, or is that too far already?
I would tend to bet that they would, because the AKP has a very is a very impressive machine. It has a very charismatic and popularly supported leader who's very good on the campaign trail. So whatever agenda that he sets, he's likely to get the support. And by the way, they also work very professionally, so the way that they set their agenda is essentially by doing a lot of public opinion polling. So unless they are certain that they are going to get the support of the people with a bit of, of course, you know, of campaigning, they probably would not put forth that sort of amendments. So whatever they put forth, I think they will get it in the referendum.
Okay, okay. This, of course, hypercharges the elections, I understand. On to Kadri. Kadri, Sinan already mentioned The Economist last week, which I'm holding in my hand, which caused quite a stir in Turkey, because The Economist, in its June 4th issue, recommended to vote for the opposition party, the CHP, because that would be better for Turkish democracy. And the government, Mr. Erdogan, reacted in a very aggressive way. He was very enraged, very much enraged by this public recommendation of The Economist. Now, tell us a bit, you know, what does this tell us about the political atmosphere at the moment in Turkey? You are part of this, of course. Mm-hmm. And then maybe in a second step, how will this translate into foreign policy?
Thank you. But before starting, thank you for your kind words. And you squeezed me to the corner with these words. I don't know how I will merit. And thank you for your institution to for inviting me and giving me opportunity to speak to this audience. Well, I'm not surprised about the situation. When I look at the Economist editor's frustration, I mean, about the AKP, I think this is the end of the paradigm for them. What was the paradigm then about the AKP? They were reading and lecturing the situation as a the AKP as a democratizing force. Well, but instead of this, if they had, I mean, read the situation as a struggle for power since 2008, they wouldn't be so surprised, and they wouldn't be so angry with the AKP, because I get the sense that there's a deception and frustration, because it's not something business as usual for the Economist to suggest, to propose to the Turkish voters to vote for the CHP. It was really create a shockwave in Turkey. Turning to the AKP's third term victory. I mean, yes, it all depends to the scale of this victory, to the number of seats. And if they get the supermajority, which means two-thirds of the seats in the parliament, 367 seats, as the prime minister has said, they will make the new constitution according to their strategy, to his strategy of becoming the first president of the Turkish Republic, and they will hijack this constitution without bringing to referendum. The prime minister himself has said openly that if they get over two-thirds, they won't take the constitution, the blueprint, to the referendum. If they don't reach 330, which means 3/5 of the parliament, well, on this situation also, the prime minister has said that recently, a couple of days ago, that depending on the parliamentary arithmetic, and if they will see and they will test the situation, and if necessary, they will go forward with the current situation, which means they will go forward with the actual current constitution, which is into force. I mean, it's not surprising me, because the current amended constitution is well and very, I mean, functional one for the AKP, and AKP is happy with it. Mr. Erdogan is happy with it. For the daily business, in a comfort zone. The Prime Minister feels himself in a comfort zone with this amended constitution, because in the latest referendum, they made everything to amend this constitution suitable for them, especially in order to rearrange the high judiciary. The case was for them the high judiciary and the party closures thing, etc. Well, but the society will not stop there, and the society, the civil society and the opposition will not be satisfied if the AKP will not get 330 seats and will put the constitution change issue on his agenda. But before concluding, there will be no, this is my, I claim that there will be no liberal constitution based on the greatest or largest consensus, negotiated and consulted one, and addressing to the needs of the Turkish society, different fragments of Turkish society, and the needs of the change, so societal change, you know. This constitution, we won't have this constitution with or without AKP in the next term. With AKP, we won't have this constitution, because the AKP will not negotiate it. They openly declared. When they don't have when they have a simple majority in the parliament, obliging them to negotiate with the different actors and different fragments of the society, they won't do so, because of the actual situation is suitable for them. But there will be a pressure. There will be certainly a pressure to have a new constitution in Turkey, because Kurds need them, Alawites need them, urbanized, middle classes need them, political actors need them, and even the Anatolian bourgeoisie, if such a fragment exists, need it. Need this change, I mean, a new brand new constitution. And Turkey, the government, at the day one, will be under pressure. And the constitution, believe me, is the best and easiest way to overcome the deepening and dangerous polarization existing in Turkey. And this polarization has been deepened by the government, by the Prime Minister himself, in a way that we didn't witness so far during a campaign. And let me give you an example. The recent one. I won't step on this long time, but just an example to how degree in Turkey the campaign degenerated and really became an abrasive and dividing phenomenon. The Prime Minister himself has said 2 days ago that if they were in the coalition government of the 99, when Mr. Öcalan was captured, they would have hanged him. And if not, If not, they would quit. They would have quit the coalition. Can you imagine? A prime minister, champion of democratization in Turkey, champion of putting the military out of the political game, ending the military tutelage regime, which is a good one, which is a good thing, I think, as a person to the AKP for winning their political struggle for power against the military and the high judiciary. But he says to get a few couple of, I mean, for I don't know how many votes from the MHP, that he would have hanged Mr. Öcalan. This is really surprising, even to me. There are three ways to overcome the very dangerous polarization which has served to the best interest to the government, to AKP so far. But at the end of the day, Turkey will be an unmanageable country, because divide and rule policy, is not a strategy, cannot be a strategy to run Turkey. There are three ways. The first way is really to engage, to change and make a new constitution, a new one, modern, liberal, based on public consensus. And so far, this is the best way to overcome the polarization in Turkey, to engage the society, engage the political actors. Second thing is much more important and much more difficult, is to renegotiate, is to reset the Turkish foreign policy and reset the Turkish EU perspective, and with a fresh start, the fresh outlook, and to engage Europeans again, to reanimate Turkish EU perspective for a sustainable and durable one. And to that end, I think after 6-7 years. Europe and Turkey must conclude that all options other than the full membership of Turkey is consumed and tested negative or failed. Mm-hmm. The French diplomacy, for example, for almost 1 year they don't mention the privileged partnership. They totally forgot about it. They don't mention, but because this is counterproductive, and for Turkey also, the new Turkish diplomacy, has proven that successfully, paradoxically, of course, successfully, that there is no alternative, a better alternative, to the EU's perspective. It is. And historically, it is also proven that in modern times there had been no other perspective or solution that had regrouped different fragments of Turkish society and policy, and political actors better than the EU perspective. Now, the formidable alliance that has regrouped, during 2003-2004, is in conflict to each other. Which is the Anatolian bourgeoisie, the business, Istanbulian business elite, the military, surprisingly, paradoxically, all political actors, middle classes, peasants, Kurds, everybody were really, engaged and were happy to see their problems, having the hope at last to be solved in this perspective, in the change that this perspective will bring to Turkey. And then this is the second option to overcome the fragmentation of Turkish society and for a better, sustainable and foreseeable Turkey in foreign policy. And to come to this term, Europe also has make its mind and give a chance to Turkey, give hand to Turkey, which I think will not be rejected. And the only thing to start, I mean, to start the engine, restart the engine, is to cut the linkage, the political linkage between the additional protocol and the trade regulations. Legal linkage between these are two separate issues. I mean, legal issues, but Turkey has created a political linkage, and by opening the harbors and airports, ports and airports to the Greek Cypriots, Turkey will have a tremendous amount of dynamism in getting the machine into force and into action, and to start negotiate with the EU. And the third thing, we can discuss it afterwards, the third thing is, I think, to engage the Kurdish question in a very serious manner, I mean, without any hidden agenda, without any, without any expectations, of political expectation, with the aim of solving this question. The first two things to do, I'm concluding, the constitution issue, can put away the obstacles which do exist in the current constitution, and can make the way open for a solution of the Kurdish question. The constitution is very important to prepare the way, the field for a solution. The second thing is also very important, to get Kurds on board again in the EU perspective, because for Kurds also, there's no alternative to the EU perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both of you. In a quick follow-up, also for both of you, I would like to ask you about a very quick assessment of the foreign policy issues. Turkey, of course, has a much more proactive kind of approach to its immediate environment, but also is reaching out to other global players in the world and to forge alliances. And Turkey, in other words, has options that maybe 10 or 15 years ago it didn't have. Now, with this election coming up, maybe Sinan can start. How is this dynamic going to play out if some of the results that you've anticipated will be realized? How will Turkey as a foreign policy player position itself after these elections?
Well, let me start with the statement that there's a slogan now that everybody likes to state about Turkish foreign policy, which was introduced in our foreign policy literature by the current foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, which is "Zero problem with neighbors." My impression is that when you try to turn this slogan into policy, you end up with a number of extremely difficult choices. And that's basically what's happening to Turkey. When I was talking a couple of days ago in another event, the following story came up. And I just want to, have a minute to tell you this story, because I think it really illustrates the problems with this approach. In the 1980s, the Bulgarian state was essentially having a number of different outreach activities among its satellite countries, one of them being Angola. So there's this general from Angola that comes to Bulgaria and goes through a training class within the Bulgarian establishment. And after a year, he goes back to Angola. And he's elevated to become the chief of staff of the Angolan armed forces. So the president calls him and asks him, okay, you've been to this training, you've had a very good training in Bulgaria, so tell me, who is Angola's biggest rival and danger? And so, and then automatically the answer is Turkey. So from an Angolan perspective. Now, obviously, this is this shows you that really, in order to have a much more fruitful and productive outcome, this cannot be a policy, zero problems with neighbors, because this very much depends on not only on Turkey, but it also depends on a number of different factors. It depends on whether your own neighbors are at peace with each other, whether your own neighbors have problems with your own allies. And by the way, some people have been calling this zero problems with neighbors, many problems with allies policy. Trying to turn this policy, trying to turn this slogan into policy has its own difficulties, as we have seen. And now we see that even more with the Arab revolts. In particular, what's happening in Syria is, of course, of very big concern. So just to answer Jan's question, I think the time has come for a reality check on Turkish foreign policy. And I think this is happening. This is happening because there is now a realization that this more perhaps ambitious and possibly naive approach to foreign policy has met its limits. So there is going to be, going forward, a reassessment of what is it that Turkey could actually do. What are the limits of Turkey's ambitions, assertiveness? And therefore, Turkish policymakers will have to revisit their positioning and their rhetoric on where they see Turkey in the grand scheme of things, whether they see Turkey as a fully reliable member of the Western community, or whether they see Turkey, as I think they have tried to construct, more as a neo-non-aligned state, acting as a regional hegemon, even if that meant a number of tensions with Turkey's traditional partners in the West. So I think the time has come, especially with what we see in the Arab world, for this reassessment to take place, and it is going to be fascinating to watch.
Thanks, Sinan. And by the way, of course, I recommend to all of you Sinan's papers for Carnegie Europe, especially his larger study that was published only very recently, and we're very thankful for having this. Kadri, I have a question. You mentioned the Kurdish issue as being one of the key issues domestically, but of course the Turkish Kurdish issue also drags Turkey into its neighborhood and very deeply into the conflicts of the neighborhood. What's the foreign policy dimension of the Kurdish question, and how is it going to play out, you think, in light of what you said earlier on the domestic front?
Well, the situation is very fluid and unpredictable now. For example, from a Syrian perspective, let's remember that Syria has conducted a zero-cost warfare against Turkey beginning from the 80s and till the end of 90s, until when they had to leave, Mr. Öcalan, leave Syria. So there is one Syrian factor which is unpredictable, and we don't know yet how Kurds will be there to play a role and how it will affect the PKK in the region. We know that in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan is a good portion of the PKK fighters are Kurds from Syria. And we don't know yet how the situation in Syria will have, what kind of an impact the situation in Syria will have, I mean, on the Kurdish issue. The Kurdish issue is also a very, a key issue, had been a very key issue in relation with Iraqi Kurds, between Turkey and Iraqi Kurds. And by this context, by this perspective, for the stability of Iraq, in the equation of peaceful relations between Iraqi Kurds and Arabs, because as long as Turkey will be a player, I mean, the de facto player in the region, in the context of Kurdish question, it's Kurdish question, of course. and will be an intervening force there. Turkey will menace always the stability in this region, I mean, by its interventions. And so Kurdish, I think the Kurdish issue in the context of the new Middle East, in the context of the best relations between Turkey and Syria, the very good relations between Iraqi Arabs and Turkey, Iraq, Baghdad himself, between also equally good relations between Iran and Turkey, had been, I mean, minimized. Because Kurds, I mean, the Kurdish movement had difficulty to brew regional alliances in this context. They were squeezed and limited in a very, I mean, tiny political maneuverability, you know? But we don't know. We don't know. It's very unpredictable, the Kurdish question. But Kurdish question, if it degenerates in Turkey and becomes a real destabilizing factor in the upcoming months and years, this will have a very, I mean, dramatic impact on Turkish foreign policy in relations with Europe and Turkey as it was. But the real, I mean, we didn't see yet the real impact of the Arab Spring on Kurdish question, because the Arab Spring had legitimized the masses' anger and manifestations and demands reflected, I mean, in these manifestations automatically. It had created a perspective of perception that in the Middle East, masses who took the streets are right. They have just demands, they have fair and legitimate demands. And by this perspective, by this angle, which suits to the global perception, I mean, if Kurds do play with the spring card and take the streets after the elections, this will be very difficult, I mean. This will be very, very difficult for the current government to convince the world, because it will create a legitimacy problem for the government. For the government. Look, so far, since the PKK started its armed rebellion against Turkish government with some separatist demands. Now, the Kurdish question has evolved in a very, I mean, has positioned itself on a very difficult situation to deal with for the government. First, they rejected separatism officially. They are not now seeking for an independent Kurdistan. They are for a kind of autonomy, which is in between the federation, confederation, something, but officially, they are not for dividing Turkey, which is, I think, very important for their access to the other portions of Kurds who were afraid of dividing Turkey, because majority of Kurds wants to live in Turkey with Turks, okay? So this is very palatable to their ears, because the PKK doesn't want to divide Turkey anymore, which makes PKK potentially an organization, a movement for all Kurds. Secondly, PKK also has started to play genuinely with the religion card. Now they are creating their own ethnic mosque. How do they do this? By organizing on Fridays separate prayers, praying, I mean, Juma namazı, separate.
Friday prayers.
Friday prayers for Kurds. Not for Kurds, but Friday prayers, where the sermon is given in Kurdish, and that's the difference. Sermon is given in Kurdish by a Kurdish mele, I mean the Kurdish imam, which is not appointed by the Turkish government, because all mosques in Turkey belong to Turkish government, I mean, because the imams are appointed by the government. These are two major issues which will create a huge headache if it's played in an intelligent way by the Kurdish movement in the future for the Turkish government.
Thank you very much. Lots of explosives here. I will now open it to our audience. I see one arm up already. We have microphones, one microphone there. Please introduce yourself. Wait till the microphone is where you are. Introduce yourself and then ask a quick question. Thank you very much. I think the first one is over here, this gentleman.
Stasinopoulos, formerly with the European Commission. On the Kurdish questions, I would like to link it with the constitutional model that may be discussed after the election. Because if some of the panelists mentioned it's very likely that Turkey will go for some kind of liberal constitution with civic elements, and I feel as you move in that direction, then issues of autonomy, regional autonomy, is becoming a much more important dimension. And I feel that's why I said I would like to link the Kurdish questions with the choices that Turkey will have in terms of what kind of model they were prepared to draft and put for discussion. Because then the challenge would be bigger. The more you go into a very liberal model, then you have no choice but to face the autonomy or regional, because that's an issue in many other European countries as well.
Shall we take another one maybe? Is there another immediate question? Okay, maybe we can answer. Please, this lady over here.
Hi, Neval Sadıkoğlu from the European Parliament. Actually, following on from the Kurdish issue, thank you to both of the speakers, firstly, of course. But can we really expect solidarity among the Kurds in Turkey? Because even on religious issues, there are Sunni and Alevi Kurds. And when we look at it historically, they haven't always supported each other when it comes to uprisings, looking at the Dersim uprising, for instance. So is it really realistic to expect some kind of a mass Kurdish nationalistic movement to come through following from the Arab Spring? Thank you.
Thanks. Both questions are very much related. I think maybe Kadri starts real quick, and then Sinan can follow up.
Well, beginning from your question, I mean, there is no such a divide in among Kurds, I mean, Alevis or Sunnis, etc. So the national cause has, I mean, has overcome this divide. And I don't think that this will prevent Kurds from forming any political alliance. This is already the Alevis are small minority among all Kurds. The Kurds are in majority are Sunnis, Shafi Sunnis. So and the PKK as a secular organization has overcome already in nationalistic terms, secular nationalistic terms, this divides. There had been, I think, yes. And for your question, yes, of course, Turkey will face, had already faced the autonomy question, problematic for them, of course, for Ankara. And now the public conscience, I mean, the public opinion do realize that there will be no peaceful solution by by not taking into account any federal or autonomous solution. There will be no solution in the framework of the unitary state, period. This, I think, the public Turkish public opinion has realized the fact, the truth. The truth is that. And Turkey will has to face, I mean, the truth sooner or later.
I would tend to disagree on this with Kadri. I think he's a bit too optimistic about the path ahead. I think that that particular realization that the Kurdish question will not be settled until there is an overall agreement about a switch to federalism or autonomy is not there yet. On the contrary, I think that many of the elements, actors in the Turkish body politic, view this as certainly a significant problem, but the first choice is really to look at how Turkey can manage the process of decentralization, giving more power to local governments. And this is really the framework today of how Turkey could, in the near future, address the Kurdish question. Now, and I think this is going to be the path that the Turkish policymakers will take, because it's obviously, first of all, easier to have a general consensus emerge about decentralization. Turkey is a very, the Turkish state model is a unitary state model after the French Republic. So again, here as well, what France did a number of years ago in terms of decentralization, devolving more power to regional, local governments, is certainly the first option that Turkey will try. So I don't see Turkey jumping from the state of play today to the question of federalism or regional autonomy without first trying this path of devolution of a number of central powers to local authorities. That also seems to be the promise of the political opposition. That also at some point was an option stated by the governing party. So I think realistically speaking, until the next electoral cycle, 4 years down the road, this is going to be the option on the table, not federalism, not regional autonomy.
May I add something to your words? I'm totally agree with you, even you are not agreed with me, but I agree with you, and it's not, I mean, contradicting what I'm saying and you, what you are saying. I didn't speak for the next 4 years, I mean. Okay. And of course, Turkey will not jump without dealing with this decentralization or devolution, etc. thing, and will not jump 2-3 steps ahead forward to federalism, autonomy, etc. Of course not, of course. But Turkey also cannot solve this question by granting Kurds some cultural rights, something like this. The Kurdish question is politicized, urbanized, and becomes a question of the masses. So we have to deal with this question on this tripod, I mean, the fact, I mean.
Thank you. We have 2-3 more questions. The first one is to the gentleman over here. And then I have one here in the first row and another one over here. I think we take all three of them and then group them together.
Can Selçuk'i, Center for European Policy Studies. First, I'd like to say that you mentioned that if the AKP were to get a supermajority, they would hijack the constitution, whereas I already believe that they hijacked it because they are running a campaign on the promise of a new constitution, yet we have heard nothing so far as to what that constitution would look like. So, in my opinion, they already hijacked it. On a separate note, you mentioned that the ethnic religious movements in the Kurdish society with the Friday prayers in Kurdish is going to pose a challenge in the coming for the coming government and in the next 4 years. But how would you assess? I think to begin with, this is a position that the Kurdish movement is taking, especially in the face of partially revitalized Hezbollah in the region, because obviously they're trying to solve this issue over their religious identity, and I think this is a position taken against the revitalized Hezbollah. So would you not say that this is even a bigger threat, a bigger challenge for the next government to solve, and that actually it gives the Kurdish society a right to sort of develop their own ethnic religious movement, because so far they're open to threats from the revitalized Hezbollah. So how do you think this is going to play out in the new era?
Thank you. Next one is up here. This gentleman.
Haluk Nuray from Economic Development Foundation. Actually, just to sum up, I'm dealing with EU affairs for 25 years, and in the last 25 years, I always been hearing about the demand for a constitutional change. Yes, there's a need, as you said, but I'm not sure if the demand is equal to the need. Demand is coming from two sources. One is demanding a more centralized and concentrated power. This is a semi-presidential system. That means almost 50 to 55% of the votes, which is 25 million votes. There's a demand for a more federalist, some federalist elements in the constitutions coming from the Kurds, call it regional autonomy or transfer of power from center, which means 5 to 6 million votes. And there's a demand for a more liberal constitution, I don't know how many votes after that. And they are contradicting targets, how it can be perceived, of these three. This is the first question. And the second question is about the EU. Whatever the result of the election is, unfortunately, there's a dangerous idea is spreading among the businesses. They are saying EU is a declining power. It's aging. It's losing power. Its share of GDP was 29% 20 years ago, and in 30 years' time, it will be only 9% of the world GDP. It's aging. Why should be on the side of a losing power? Why should we stay with the losers? And unfortunately, it's more and more accepted nowadays. How it will affect the EU-Turkey relations in the coming 10, 20 years.
Thank you. And then we take a third one over here.
Thank you. Oscar Benedict, External Action Service. Just wanted to ask, imagine that the AKP reaches the two-thirds majority and they go ahead with a constitution. It was mentioned that it's not at all clear what is their plans, actually. Do you think that this will be tackling all these problems you have been mentioning, or will it just be consolidating the power from the center, establishing a more dictatorial way of acting, establishing a power vertical through all the institutions, and therefore going in a tendency which is not at all what anybody around would like to see? So how much a likelihood is that? Not tackling the real problems, but instead developing this kind of dictatorial system. And my second question is, I mean, I also hear about the EU. I've myself been 5 years in Turkey. It's always the same talk. It's 10, 15 years, the same problems. Nothing has been solved. And only the EU attraction has lost out somehow because perhaps of the crisis we see, the euro crisis and so on. So if this federating factor is falling away, will this not reinforce even then these tendencies that we have seen in the past through the AKP party for a more, let's say, dictatorial system?
Thanks, excellent. That's a wide array of issues. Sinan, would you like to maybe start?
Yeah, with addressing some of those issues. Now, regarding the AKP's own plans for a constitutional change, I think we can, if we look back what happened a year ago, which I think tends to shed light on what would happen if AKP would get the mandate to change the constitution. What happened a year ago when Turkey had adopted another constitutional change is basically on the strength of its parliamentary seats. AKP imposed its own version of the constitutional change and used the popularity of its of Prime Minister Erdogan to actually gain public support to a referendum for this. Very interestingly, the way that they campaigned is they portrayed this as a reform of the Turkish judicial system. Now, I would wholeheartedly support the need for a reform of the judicial system in Turkey. It has many problems. Turkey is not known to distribute justice in a fair, equitable, and timely manner. But what was done was not that. What was done is essentially an outcome of the power struggle, trying to impose their own influence over the Turkish judiciary. And that was very different from what the country needed in terms of a judicial reform. So this element of trying to establish power over almost all state institutions is, I think, very prevalent in the Prime Minister's thinking. He does not do checks and balances. He abhors checks and balances. I think the willingness here to establish a presidential system is exactly an outcome of that. And therefore, again, I would agree with the economist that it would be inimical to Turkish democracy if AKP would once more get the ability to impose its own version of the constitutional order, which would be underpinned by a presidential system. It is contrary to what Turkey needs. It's contrary to the type of really democratic checks and balances that we need to develop, firstly in the constitution, to ensure the right way forward. Now, on the EU question, Haluk, as you know, we've been working on this for many number of years now. You said 25. You may be right, you know. And we are extremely frustrated in Turkey, the few of us who still believe in this idea. We are, by and large, an endangered species now. But we come to the realization that at the end of the day, as things stand, it is really more about what Europe does and how Europe evolves than what Turkey does and how Turkey evolves. Looking at the experience of past enlargements, it was very clear that there was an obvious European willingness, political will for enlargement to take those countries in. That political will has been lacking in the Turkish case. So there is that question that needs to be settled. But I would tend to argue another thing, and that is that Europe itself must sort and settle its own problems. And it must acquire the confidence that it once had as a society, as an entity, as a model. And unless that happens, enlargement to a country where people actually are pretty happy, that they are pretty confident about their own future as a society, as a country, is not going to happen. It's not going to happen because the pull factor that the EU had for a long number of years has disappeared. For a country like Turkey, it's still there for some of the countries in Western Balkans because, I mean, the geopolitical situation is not the same and the needs are not the same. But Turks today are quite happy. Happy is not the right word. But having a future without the EU has become a manageable destiny for Turkey. And it was not like that 10 years ago. And if the EU does not settle its own problems, I'm afraid this is how things will continue to diverge.
Kadri, your take on the questions that we've heard.
Yes. For hijacking the constitution on the issue is obviously clear. The Prime Minister is asking 367 for a new constitution from the masses coming to listen to him. But he doesn't reveal the content. even he didn't declare any sets of normative principles on that issue. On the contrary, CHB had done. Sorry. And yes, this is the he is asking an open check for the constitution, and afterwards he said, I need 367 seats in the parliament to have a new constitution of our own. But then he said, if I get 367, I won't ask the people to vote for it. So this is a paradox. It's very paradoxical, I mean. The Kurd religion and Kurds, I mean, there is already an ethnic religious movement called Hezbollah in the southeast. The question is for the PKK, for the Kurdish movement, I mean nationalist movement, is that now the Kurdish movement is establishing some legitimate way of dialogue and or presentation with the pious Kurds, and it's is reconstituting its image and standing through religion, and also through this expanding its electorate. I mean, what can I say else? And it's a new phenomenon, and the what the AKP has done so far, from the day one in power, they have act under the they have act by being guided by their, I mean, ideological instincts, giving the priority to the Ummah philosophy, and seeking a solution to the Kurdish question through the common religious identity, which has been proven false in the political practice, and to the perception of the EU by Turks. I mean, the EU as an aging force in crisis, many crises. Losing its attractiveness to Turks. But look. When you look around 360 degrees, still the EU is the better or the best alternative. And there is no such an alternative like the EU. The question is that Turkey's own dynamics are not enough to solve its own problems. It has never been enough, and being realistic, Turkey needs a disciplinary, contribution from the outside, and there is no better alternative in this context to the EU. And I think the crisis is in. I think the crisis is ephemeral. I don't think that this will end up with the end of the EU project. Even the EU zone can tremble, etc., can shake up a little bit. But I think the EU must remain as a non-alternative force. Well, it's excuse me. The anchoring Turkey to the EU was the motto created by François Mitterrand. And for the EU also, there's no better way to anchor Turkey than to give Turkey a clear perspective, not open-ended one, a clear perspective ending in full membership. And it has been proven, because as you mentioned, I guess Turkey becomes an elephant, you know. It's like an elephant, I mean, and it has to be, I mean, control himself, or to be put in some legitimate and justifiable limits. I mean, in this context, if Europe propose, recommend to this actual government, to the AKP, revitalizing the process, reset, I mean, the process, and to make a new commencement in these terms, the AKP cannot reject it. If the AKP rejects it, it will destroy its legitimacy. So make to the AKP an undeniable proposition and take the AKP on board again when they were, I mean, in 2003, 2004, and we will have a new paradigm.
Thank you very much. I would like to insert two final ones from my side, one on long-term prospects and one on the here and now. Sinan, you mentioned 2023 as a possible perspective politically. Now, what are the long-term political perspectives in terms of majorities? We see that Turkish society is very much in motion. It's a very young society. The youth is repoliticizing itself after a long abstinence from the political scene. You said that the major opposition party is, you know, really getting its act together and is becoming more of a viable force. If you wanted to, you know, dare doing a long-term projection, how is this going to change majorities in the future? And the second one, that's the long-term one, that is the here and now on foreign policy. Turkey initially in the Libya question was very much reluctant, even kind of opposed, and they've totally changed their position. They have now released 100 million euros for the rebel council in Libya, basically the alternative government, if you will, and now very much in support of the changes there. What does this mean for Turkey's role in the region, in its immediate neighborhood, and for the responsibility maybe Turkey wants to take in the region? I don't know who wants to start.
Yeah, I'll start. 20 years down the road, or 2023 perhaps, even less, how is the political configuration going to change? Traditionally, Turkey has, when you look at the political topography of the country, it's essentially a country that traditionally has voted for the center-right to, you know, with a 65 to 35 divide. At times, this was even more, 70-30. But traditionally, it's about 65-35. In exceptional times, it became 55-45. But that's only happened once in Turkish political history. So whatever happens, and these are, you know, deep underlying trends, Turkey will remain a politically conservative society, which means that no matter what we see, this type of balance will remain. The question is, and here there are two structural problems with Turkish democracy. One is really the lack of political dynamism, and that is essentially due to the very high threshold of 10%. Because once you have that threshold in place, it makes it almost impossible for new parties to emerge. Almost impossible for new parties to emerge. Because this translates into 4.5 million votes that you need to get to clear the threshold. And that's quite a significant barrier. I mean, that's more than, you know, the population of many EU states. But it's also a very expensive proposal. This is a country of 75 million people. And you need to sell your product, your political product, to 75 million people, day in, day out. And that, again, is a very expensive thing. So if we are able to tackle this issue of national threshold and reduce it to more acceptable limits, that is going to insert a new political dynamism. It is going to create the right conditions for political contestability, where we would then see the emergence of new figures, new parties, possibly, and therefore that would lead to new coalitions with new actors on the ground, and we won't see these type of parties getting 45-50% or even 65% of the seats with 34% of the vote like it happened in 2002. But the more normal type of political representation, where many of the segments of Turkish society would feel that they are actually represented. And that is also one of the problems, because now you only have the option with, you know, the two big part or the three big parties. And there are many people out there, youth especially, who feel they're not represented. They either don't go out to vote, or if they do vote, they, you know, vote for either protest votes or just because their parents voted for one party or the other. And that's not a particularly good way to establish this type of political connections. So I think this is fundamentally what Turkey needs to do. And that, of course, sketches a far more uncertain future in terms of who is going to be in power, what sort of coalitions will emerge. But I think at the end of the day, it will be a much more satisfactory future for Turkish politics if we are able to really increase political dynamism and really insert contestability in our political system. On Libya and the evolution of Turkish foreign policy, the first thing that it shows is that Turkey is not in fiscal duress. You know, the ability to really give 100 million euros just like that, I think shows that one demonstrates one of the driving forces of this transformation of Turkish foreign policy, which is state capacity, economic capacity. And that is going to remain in place. Many analysts predict that, you know, Turkish growth will continue, and as long as that will continue, Turkey will continue to have an ambitious agenda for its own foreign policy. The second thing is that, in particular in Libya, but also in Syria, and I think that's even a more acute case than Libya for Turkey, the government was caught a bit unprepared to the implications of the Arab Spring. Now, I can't really blame Ankara. I suppose many of the countries, in particular France, also got unprepared with the implications of the Arab Spring. So there has been a very much pragmatic and policy, and you can claim, you know, devoid of principles. So what Turkey did in Libya and perhaps in Syria is really to follow a very pragmatic policy based on a realistic assessment of its national interest and not so much a normative policy based on a categorical approach to refusing to deal with the autocratic leaders and being strongly on the side of the quote-unquote democratic opposition. And that, I think, is really a fundamental issue that an influential regional actor, which is growing in influence, is going to face. There is no way to evade this. And so as long as you have interests and you will have to take those interests into account, it's going to be enormously difficult to really adopt a much more normative-based foreign policy, which, of course, will make you open to criticism. But again, that's something that certainly has been known to most of the major powers in the world, and I think Turkey is getting starting to feel the pressure as a regional power.
Thank you, Kadri. We have two or three more minutes.
Okay, so I will be bold and short and on this issue. Turkish foreign policy was already stuck before the Arab Spring, stuck in its relations with the West, with the EU, and stuck into major issues that has, I mean, undertaken, first Iran and second Israel. And that's why I'm defending a reset also is needed in Turkish foreign policy. And Arab Spring has caught Turkey unprepared, of course, well, the world was unprepared, but the response coming from Turkey was really paradoxical and unbalanced, and also, well, in terms of real politics, but where is the highly acclaimed policy of establishing a new order in the Middle East, or establishing together with other regime a new order in the Middle East, etc., or defending the principles, etc. So it is really the response given from Turkey to the Arab Spring was characterized by its own crude national and economic interests, and saying loudly go to Mubarak, and then shying away when it comes to Libya, being perplexed, and Syria is, I think, the major issue to conclude, and this is the end of the so-called ambition or policy or principle, whether you name it, zero problem with neighbors issue. It comes to an end in Libya, but to me it was already come to an end in Lisbon in November in the context of relations with Iran. And there I remember a senior retired diplomat saying a couple of months, 2 months ago in Ankara in a meeting like this, that in Syria, if Turkey managed this crisis of its own with Syria in an inefficient way, you can multiply by zero Turkey's influence in the region, because Syria was the test case or the major case of the implementation of new Turkish foreign policy in the region. This was the country that Turkey has most invested. 2 months ago in the Brussels forum, you were there, maybe you might have witnessed how Westerners were full of hope or expectations from Turkey to deal with the Syrian issue, while saying that the West or the EU had a limited capacity to deal with it, and they were putting their bet on Turkey. But Turkey, so far, didn't give a high-profile response to what's going on in Syria, and didn't influence the regime to stop massacring its own people. So this is return to normal. When one policymaker puts his stakes higher, its policy will be judged through these stakes, and this is the mistake that Turkey has done so far.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for both of your insights here. Thank you very much to all of you for staying so long. Before I release all of you, please mark your calendars on the 22nd of June. We'll have another breakfast meeting like this one, then trying to look at the... it's going to be a lunch meeting, even better. Sorry for this. We will be looking at the results of the elections. And then Sinan will be there again. We've had two very critical voices here this morning. For the post-election thing, we will also have an expert coming to Carnegie Europe, who will be probably a little more supportive of the current government, so that we have a mix of opinions on this as well. Thank you very much again. Thanks for your questions and for your patience. Enjoy the long weekend. Bye-bye.
İnşallah kampanyayı tutar. Inşallah.